The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyot.
My name is Michael Guyot, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining for the hour, Julia Cordova has got a hell of a following on YouTube and on Twitter. I'm sure many of you follow her. Julia, first time you and I are talking, talk about for a moment here your background. Who are you? How'd you get involved in markets? And how do you look at markets now?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I'm just a retail investor that somehow turned into a trader. And now that is how I make my living. So I started out just like everybody else. I had sort of a normal job and I was just putting money into my 401k. I decided to manage my own funds rather than just have them kind of just, I don't even know, you know, high risk, low risk. I don't know. I just decided to buy companies that I liked. And so when I stopped working, I wanted to move to Florida and find a job that I could not travel in. And I just decided to start trading. So it was just like that.
And in terms of your prior career, because obviously it's a big decision to stop what you're doing and go full-time trading. What were you doing?
I was selling software into pharmaceutical and biotech companies. So I would sell drug discovery software.
And I recall in hearing some of your prior interviews that your education was much more on the engineering side, correct?
Yes, I have a degree in mechanical engineering, but I interned at a company a long time ago, but it was clear that I was a little different. So I decided not to pursue that.
Presumably there are some aspects when it comes to engineering that you can maybe apply to investing in markets. I mean, as I recall, Lynn Alden also, I think, has an engineering background, and she's talked about how some of that thought process goes into her own way of looking at markets. Is there anything from your education that you can look back on and say this applies or doesn't apply to, you know, a chaotic system like the stock market?
That's a really good question. I agree that I think the thought process behind an engineering degree is really what I wanted to sort of get down in school. I think in particular, I happen to be a channel trader. I tried a bunch of different things when I first started. I mean, I think I went through the rigmarole of different ways to trade, different strategies, different technical analysis. And I decided to become a channels trader because I could see how the algos, because it is mostly machines now that are, you know, trading, so to speak, I could see how the algos were respecting different slopes. So I think based on my engineering background, it probably made it a little bit easier for me to see that. So that is what works for me.
Okay, so interesting. So that makes sense, right? You're looking for something that's systematic, that's repeatable.
Yes.
And as we know, right, the challenge with markets is that you can look at a large data set and say, okay, on average, this channel, these buy, sell entry points work. But there are always times where the cycle is not in your favor. The approach is not favoring, for whatever reason, those buy and sell points. Now, you reference this idea that you look at different, you've gone through the runaround as far as different strategies, different indicators. How do you know if your approach is something that's sustainable when it's not working, right? Because I think that's always the challenge that traders have, which is that How do they know whether they should abandon an approach or simply wait out the environment that they're in?
That is a very good question. And I took scientific method to do that. So when I was first starting to trade, you know, I had seen on television or a movie, I don't know, but I figured the more indicators I had, the smarter I would become and the better I would be at it. And it turns out that was not correct for me, at least. So what I tried to do was I tried to sort of start from scratch with just the very minimal things. And then I would just add one type of thing at a time and sort of take notes of whether or not that worked for me. And then sort of back that off, try something else, and then try the two things together. I mean, it was a whole recursive partitioning.
A lot of trial and error, right.
Yeah, recursive partitioning, trial and error, whatever it is. It was really, it was more systematic and symptomatic, I suppose, because it drove me a little crazy. But it was the way that worked for me. You hear someone, it's like a dog getting distracted by squirrel, because you hear something works for somebody and you try that. And then just as you're realizing that that might or might not work for you, something else comes into mind. So you try this other thing. So that method, that scattershot method was not working for me. So I just tried to cut out all the noise and just try and be very systematic until I found something that worked consistently for me.
So I think this is a good thing to kind of tease out further, because I'm a big fan, and it sounds like you are as well, of simplicity. Don't overcomplicate a strategy with too many indicators, because what happens is that the more indicators you overlay on top of each other, not only is there, let's call it analysis paralysis, right? But you end up having maybe a situation where you create almost like a Frankenstein, because the more indicators you have, even though it might look like on average it works better, one, it could be randomness, and two, every indicator has its own false signals. So you kind of create this strange correlation dynamic, not just in terms of the signals lining up, but in terms of the errors and the false signals not lining up, right, so to speak. So let's talk about that maybe a little bit further. What are some of the things that you've tried and tested that you find don't work, that you think other people maybe mistakenly focus on?
Well, whatever works for somebody else is fine by me. I will, instead, I'm going to answer the question a little bit reverse. So I use RSI a lot. I draw trend lines on RSI as well as on my price action charts. And then occasionally I'll have somebody tell me, that's a lagging indicator. And I understand why they believe that it is, but I actually am a huge fan of RSI. I'm a huge fan of the slopes there, support and resistance. And so I'm just, instead of telling you what is overrated, I'll tell you that I think RSI is underrated. I love it in particular. I love it.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of traders in prior conversations that have noted that relative strength is perhaps the most persistent phenomenon, right, when it comes to market dynamics. When you're going through periods, though, where, let's say, RSI is not responding in the way that you hoped it would, when you're looking at support resistance or trend changes, how do you manage risk in those periods? Because I think a lot of people, especially on FinTwit, they make it seem like not only they're always right, but they're always right with magnitude. And it's very hard to get it right and then right with magnitude, because if you're going to get it right with magnitude, you have to be willing to risk also with magnitude on the downside that the signal's wrong.
Correct. And I am definitely not always right, for sure. I mean, I think I'm right more than I'm not right. But I mean, really what it boils down to for me is when I have high confidence level, that's when I will risk more. So I don't mind being wrong at all, because everybody's wrong. I mean, if there's somebody out there that's pretending to never be wrong, they're either a liar or a fraud. So what I try to do is I try to measure my confidence level in something, and then I try to manage my position size in the same way that I do my confidence level. So, and sometimes the confidence level changes. Sometimes, you know, so what I do is every week I sort of look at a variety of things, and I try to come up with what I believe are the highest confidence trades and biases that I can have. And sometimes, you know, even by Monday morning, it's completely changed, but it's easy to see that with the levels. So the way that I manage that is simply just having basically a level in which it's like, nope, that didn't work. And you know, sometimes too, instead of just a level, I will give something a time. So, you know, if I'm working with hourly charts, I'll say, you know what, especially the way my lines work, a lot of them are based on closes, either above or below lines. So I'll give something a time-based stop as well. And then I will beg out. And so yesterday with oil, I tried to catch it three different times. And the third time, it was so close, and I could have taken profit each time, but I didn't, because I was sort of trying to catch a real bottom. But the third time afterwards, I cut it, and then I saw a price going higher, and I was like, oh no, and then I was like, you know what? No, that's my rules. If I try three times, I'm just not going to try again. So I have to wait till tomorrow. So it's really just about being aware, peripherally aware of the levels that you're trading, knowing when you're wrong, and then having discipline about, even if I missed it yesterday, which I did not, but even if I, or, you know, I missed a bottom because it's lower today, but even if I missed it, I can't look back on it. I just have to say, you know what? I tried. I cut my losses pretty early. I'm good.
So I think the focus on the word confidence is interesting in relating it to weightings, because you can be max confident, but that doesn't mean you should be 100% in that confidence in terms of how much you position, right, in a portfolio. And I'm just more for my own curiosity. Do you sort of have your own self-imposed percentages for how much you would allocate to a particular position?
I do. And I can get a little degenerate, not going to lie. I definitely do. But, you know, I will say, if I'm feeling extraordinary confidence, that usually gives me, I'll put less of something into it, because I know if I'm feeling extraordinarily confident, I'm probably wrong. So if it's when I'm feeling somewhat confident that I'm usually in my zone.
Okay. No, I love that point, because that's where I think a lot of people get it wrong in terms of assessing themselves, right? In terms of overconfidence, right? Because if you have too much confidence and you're overconfident, you might be believing a narrative that may not actually be true. And it's ultimately about not fooling yourself in terms of how much that narrative could actually explain the unknowable tomorrow.
Every single time I think to myself, this won't go lower, or this can't get any higher, I screw myself. So I try to always keep in mind that things can always get worse. Things can always go higher. So I just have to sort of either scale in or have a plan to deal with that. And usually if I think something, you know, I shorted oil recently at about the 122, 123 area. And you know, I did not have a boatload of confidence, but it was the first time I had been eyeballing it for several weeks. And it was the first time I had gotten into the conditions that I was looking at to go short. So I did, but I didn't go bananas the first week. And then it did go a little bit higher the next week. And I added back what I had sold. And so it worked out for me. But that's what I mean. Like, if ever I'm, you know, oh, this is a sure thing. I know for sure I'm wrong even before I place the trade. I don't counter trade myself in that scenario, but I just know, oh, this is bad. You know, I'm completely confident. And just that happens too. Whenever I win a bunch of trades in a row, I get a little smug and then something knocks me down. And so that's good, right? You always have to, okay, I got too smug. I knew it was coming, you know, that kind of thing.
So I think, again, I think this whole discussion's particularly interesting in the context of, I think there's a difference also in terms of how males versus females respond to confidence. So there's a lot of studies that show that when you look at hedge fund managers who are women, right, they actually way outperform their male counterparts. And I forget the name of the paper that documented that, but one of the conclusions was that, or one of the theories around that, as far as why women tend to be better than men at trading, is because they don't take on excessive risk at the wrong time. Whereas you can argue men that are overconfident in a thesis would very heavily overweight something. It would be counter to the way you're presenting it, which would be that if you're overconfident, it actually makes you doubt it. I don't know. To me, it's just kind of an interesting dynamic because there is, I think, an aspect to trading which has to do with risk-seeking versus risk-averse behavior. And we know from a lot of studies that men and women respond to risk in different ways.
That is really interesting. I did not know that. That is fascinating, actually. I tend to think, I've heard a study before where if you're in an elevator and you press a button, if it doesn't light up, a man will say, you know, what's wrong with this elevator? And a woman might think to herself, you know, oh, I must have pressed it. I didn't press it hard enough. But I have to tell you, I'm like, what the heck is wrong with this elevator? It's I'm like the first person to think that. So that's really interesting about the differences in men and women trading.
Yeah, at least from a kind of a risk management perspective, it kind of goes back to this point that, you know, in the long term, it's about, I keep using that line on Twitter, to kill in the stock market, you have to not get killed. Now, in my world, the risk off expression, this is why I keep on putting out all these charts that showing this anomaly in terms of the interaction of stocks to treasuries. In my world, risk off is treasuries. And the idea of trying to avoid big declines in equities is to play treasuries in those declines. But what am I supposed to do when treasuries are declining so hard? How do you think through this kind of environment? So you've been trading for a while, and I think it's unbelievably clear that this is an anomaly, even though most people are just using recency bias to extrapolate out to the future, thinking this is normal. But how do you think about analyzing in this kind of a weird environment where things are not behaving the way that you might otherwise think they should?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Well, that's a good question. I also wouldn't, I don't know that there's a normal, but I do know that we're in a lot of volatility right now. So I just try to keep my position sizes small. Well, I try to figure it out. If you ever ask me a question like, hey, why is XYZ happening? My answer would be because price action, blah, blah, blah. I will never be able to. I am not smart enough. I don't know. I'm not someone who can look at all of the, because nothing makes sense to me ever. Whenever I think things should go down, whenever I think things should go up, when I just use my brain, it's almost always not correct. So I really do try to focus just on price action. And the price action is actually making a fair bit of sense still. It's just super volatile. It's just, you can be right and someone else can be right at the same time that has an exact opposite opinion, but on a different time frame. So for me now, it's just about managing the volatility more than it is the directionality.
That's another interesting discussion to go down, right? Which is that on the one hand, things are volatile, but you can argue that at least historically, volatility should be higher, right? A lot of people have been referencing VIX levels and making the point that, you know, yeah, they're elevated, but it's not as elevated as you might think it would be given the context of everything else happening around us. And that point about volatility and direction is important, right? So whenever I talk about risk on, risk off, I always make it a point. It's not about direction. Risk on, risk off is about volatility. Risk on is lower average stock market volatility going forward. Risk off is higher average stock market volatility going forward. And that matters because it's in the higher volatility states when you tend to have the real big drawdowns, right? It's sort of the way I like to frame it. But let's talk about that interaction of volatility and trend following, right? As well as risk management, because when you're in a higher volatility regime, you can get stopped out faster, even though it may just be noise and randomness. When you're in a lower volatility regime, you might end up having a false sense of confidence that you can't have a big decline. So talk about risk management when volatility regimes are changing in your world.
So yesterday morning, we were trading the hourly chart, and I always try to wait. And when I'm just day trading, I try to wait for the first hour or so just to see where things settle out. And so basically I set these different levels as, okay, if the hourly closes above this level, then I'm going to buy the dip on the next candle. And so I would do that. And then, you know, basically holding now until it closes back then above that level. And then I think we'll squeeze, for example. But for me, rather than just looking at the VIX, I'm just looking at these candles. Yesterday's candles were crazy. They were crazy in the morning. To me, they seemed crazy. It just seemed like they were huge swings back and forth. And I just try to sort of keep my position size small. I try to have a plan about when to add or when to take profit. And I just try to manage my FOMO, because you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, things could go way up after I sell and I could be like, oh no, but then they can always come back down again. And it seems like they do. So I've been sort of cautiously trying to play what I believe is an intermediate swing to the upside, but it's incredibly hard. And because of that, I just try to be disciplined about taking profit at resistance and then adding back either above that or on another dip below it. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah, no. But that's always I go back to that's why this business is so much harder than people realize, exactly because, as you alluded to, sometimes you sell at a profit and then it keeps running higher, right? Then you regret. You know, it's so easy with hindsight to say, oh, I should have waited. I should have done this. I should have done that. Or it was the quote unquote wrong trade. But it's not that it's a wrong trade if something keeps going higher or if you sold at a low. It's that over time, the process lends you to have, on average, more returns.
Right. Yes, I 1,000% agree with you. And sometimes I like to trade in scales. And so sometimes I even leave on a FOMO scale of a third, because I know that if I don't have just something inside of that trade, that I'm going to have great amount of anxiety. So I'd almost rather have the trade come back down with me in it rather than me not be in it. Do you know what I mean? So I try to get my profit done in the first two scales and leave on a scale, even if I have to set then, okay, break even is when I'm getting out of it. It helps me.
Do you find it's easier to identify mean reversion trades versus trending trades? I know that sounds strange, but I've always, myself, from my own backtesting, found that it's a lot easier to identify an extreme to bet against than to try to exactly identify where a trend, quote-unquote, starts and stops. Because oftentimes, for example, if you use a moving average, which a lot of people reference as identifying what a trend is, it doesn't necessarily tell you about direction as much, again, as about volatility changing. Whereas mean reversion is about direction.
So I don't think I'd call it mean reversion, but I am definitely known for being a contrarian. I think I'm best at inflection points of things that have been trending and potentially could change. I think that's probably what I'm best at in general. I mean, trend following to me is just simply not interesting. It's I was in uranium just last year, a while back. And so I stuck it in my investment account and it's been going up, and I don't have any interest in talking about it because it's not interesting. It's just doing its thing. I would much prefer to talk about things that potentially could change direction, when they might change direction, and trying to, for me, that's just much, it's easier for me, and it's more fun to talk about.
Yeah, and it's almost like an SEO argument, right? It's like you want to talk about the things which are maybe at an inflection point, which, being contrarian, you can argue is really ultimately about, to some extent, you're trying to say something which is maybe counting the crowd based on some observation versus something that might be trending quietly that nobody really cares about because it's not terribly exciting.
Right. Well, I kind of got popular by accident. I really wasn't trying to be even exciting. I just look at what's exciting to me and talk about that. So yeah, but that's what I do.
All right. So you mentioned uranium. I am curious if when you go out there and screen for different stock ideas, are you doing it more on the bottom up, micro individual stock level? Or are you saying to yourself, okay, there's a theme in play, like oil as an example. Let me choose the strongest, charts based on that. Because, and again, this is just based on my own research and other analysis I've seen. I think a lot of people get stuck on individual stocks, sort of choosing the individual fish that might lead the pack, as opposed to trying to look at where the entire pack is moving.
Gotcha. Well, so what I do on a weekly basis is I look at the indices. I look at oil, natural gas, oil stocks, and XOP, for example. I'll just look at an ETF that's sort of an amalgamation of all of them, or a representation of them. And then I'll look at the precious metals, and I'll look at miners, GDX. So just a representation of them. And then I will try to figure out for the week, the most high probability setups in all of them. And so that's I feel it's an advantage, because I think what tends to happen is, and myself included, if you like a particular stock, it tends to, humans sometimes get emotional about something. And especially if the first time you traded this stock, it treated you well. You got a lot of profit. And then it becomes like you can't even see anything outside of this particular stock because you're so focused on this one thing that gave you profit this one time. So I try my best not to fall for that, because I'm aware that it exists. And so instead, I just look for high, as if the charts were nothing but just charts. I just look for the highest probability setup based on the actual candles that have formed. And, sometimes, like I said, sometimes I'm incorrect, but I tend to be, I think, more correct than not in general. And that's all I'm looking for is just, I gave up a long time. I don't try to win every single trade, but I do try to be consistent and win more than I lose. And I do try to play, I do actually place more monetary value in things that I am more confident in. I do.
So, Julia, I always chuckle when I see on your YouTube videos the not financial advice in the background, and I've made fun of that on Twitter before, that people will tweet out about buying this or selling that and saying things like this cryptocurrency or that cryptocurrency is a store of value and it's going up, but then there's a little asterisk which is implied, which is not financial advice, right? And which is kind of funny, because we're all trying to navigate and position, and we're all saying things which sound like advice, but it's not supposed to be financial advice, right? So I am curious, in terms of how you look at FinTwit, if you think that maybe a lot of people are doing a disservice to others in the way that they categorically seem to argue for a particular position that they themselves are in terms of making others who don't really understand the analysis chase what they themselves are saying.
I can see that. I mean, I think that if somebody has an opinion and if they feel strongly about it, I can see why they would want to advocate for their opinion. Sometimes I'll talk about individual stocks, but not often. And It's only when I feel, when I see the chart and I think, you know what, that's a good opportunity that I'll do something like that. It's disheartening to see pump and dump type things. I don't follow. I don't think a lot of the people that do that, but it's disheartening. And I feel badly for people who are, because, you know, I can do it too. I have a superpower of sounding extraordinarily confident when I'm truly not. I mean, when Tesla was in, on a parabola, I shorted it for the first time at 650, and I was not confident in it. Like I said, if I was super confident, I'd be like, oh no, but I was not confident, but it turned out it worked out okay, because it went down about 10% within 3 days. But I can understand, as a new trader especially, you're just looking for certainty. I mean, the market loves certainty, and so do traders. And if somebody sounds certain about something, it makes other people want to get in on that, because, wow, they sound like they know what they're talking about. They sound extremely confident. And then it turns out that wasn't a good thing. So I just try not to sound too confident when I'm not.
Yeah, and I always go back to, it's like, that's, humility seems to be lacking on social media. And there's a lot of unfortunate cherry picking of wins versus losses, right? I think that makes for a sort of a false sense of confidence, which is why a lot of people will follow gurus of the moment, when in reality could just be randomness. And, you know, somebody saying that something can go up is, I would argue, irrelevant, because it's always about the price that you pay prior to it going up.
Right.
I can't tell you how many people I've seen that will say that they've called some major trade correctly, but okay, they may have called it correctly in terms of looking at a chart, but where they enter is really what matters, right? And that's, I think, is a very important piece of data that people don't reference.
Yeah, I agree with you. So before the pandemic, in about January, I started getting short, and I was getting my butt handed to me because we kept going higher, just grinding higher. And, you know, I knew, I could see the news. I knew something bad was going to happen. I felt strongly in it, but I did well in terms of when I got into the volatility products, but in terms of the shorts on the indices, I was not doing great for, you know, about a month and a half or so. And it was hard. And, but you're right. I mean, I ended up doing okay because of what happened, but I certainly did not short the exact top. And then just, I mean, I might have gotten a really good position in TVIX and UVIXY, but I did not. That was after a lot of losing days for months. It was terrible. So you're exactly right. I mean, it's sometimes when you have conviction about something and you feel this is happening, it is about the entry rather than your actual, you know, what actually ends up happening. I mean, it was okay in the end, but I'm just saying I did not have perfect entry, but that was okay. I did maintain my bearishness, you know, I did maintain that. So that's all I needed.
And I think the challenge there is you've got to be able to maintain a viewpoint, maintain your mental fortitude and emotional cadence when you put content out there that's wrong in the moment, and then people want to pile on you for being quote unquote wrong. And I've been seeing this a lot the last several days with my own Twitter account. Anybody that's been doing this for a while will see that, where you have a period where you inevitably go through a drawdown. Something's not working the way that you hoped it would. The environment's not favoring your approach. I'm talking personally now, given my own approach. And it's like, people want to pile on. And it seems silly to me, because we're all trying to deal with, again, the unknowable tomorrow. I've got skin in the game. It's my career. I'm going through a nasty drawdown and all my strategy. I'm very open about it. In your case, correct me if I'm wrong with this, you know, you left your career to do trading full time. So there's a lot of pressure you put on yourself too, because this is how you generate your income. So I am sure you also, in a different way, feel it when people, you know, trolls, let's call it, will go after you saying you are wrong on this, you're wrong on this, and you're going through the loss. And it's not like you want to be wrong on it, because it's also about your own ability to pay for expenses.
Exactly. But, you know, I tend to find, and it is human nature, I think, to, when people are going through their own pain, whatever it is, they would like to blame somebody aside from themselves. And so, or They would just like to feel better about themselves by making somebody else out to be worse, as opposed to spending the time and mental energy trying to get better at whatever it is they're doing and focusing on, okay, how can I, you know, do better next time? How can I prevent this kind of drawdown? How can I do that? Is it something that you can't prevent? Maybe you can't prevent drawdowns. Maybe it's something that you need to learn to accept as a business expense, because that's how it works. Nobody's perfect. Nobody is without losses. And, you know, frankly, I'd rather be open about them than hide them, because it's, if you're going to be a trader, if you're going to be successful, you have to learn to embrace those losses, because that is where the learning comes in. And that is where the methodology comes in of then being consistent over time in terms of being able to cut them or to realize when you're wrong. I just got long for bonds for the first time a few weeks ago, I think. And I took profit last week, probably a little early because it got a little bit higher this week. But I think they're about to go up personally. So I'm going to buy the next dip that I see. Again, I'm going to buy back what I sold. It looks to me like they are bottoming out, but I started to watch it to monitor inflation. And then when I realized just in my, there are very few advantages to living in my small town. But one of them is that I think that I see things happening before it might happen in a larger place. So I started to think to myself that maybe potentially inflation might be, if not going down from then on, but basically starting its descent, starting a descent, I should say. So that's why I decided to go long, because I thought that that would be an inverse way to do it.
And which credit quality are you talking about there, Julie? You talk about, you know, treasuries, you're talking about high yield?
TLT. So yep. Yeah.
Which is the proxy. And that's everything I keep putting these posts about. So whenever people talk about bonds selling off, you have to keep making a distinction across which bonds. Treasuries are really unique. And I don't think people really fully appreciate this idea that, that's why I keep showing the data, even though people keep countering, not understanding what I'm saying. Treasuries, unlike high yield, benefit from stock market volatility on average, whereas high yield correlates much more to stock market movement, because when volatility is rising in equities, when you have a VIX spike, credit spreads will widen. So junk debt ends up selling off harder. High yield becomes higher yield. Treasuries become the safe haven play. Now, this is kind of an interesting discussion too, Julia, which is that when you think about treasuries as the flight to safety asset for a moment, right? Aside from the, whether it's a discussion around whether it's an overshoot on yields or not, the idea that treasuries are a flight to safety asset. More often than not, that tends to be the case that when stocks go down hard, treasuries, TLT as the example, will rise in price, yield will drop on the long end. But you've had plenty of times, like in 2008, as an example, where post Lehman, treasuries sold off, but then you had this sort of real rip higher in November, December of 08. Stocks kept on going lower, yields were collapsing, and you could have basically undone and then some the entire Lehman collapse if you simply rotated to treasuries at the right time to close out the year. And I say that only because when you have patterns like that, especially with treasuries, even when you're in a drawdown, you still have a chance at coming back very suddenly and very aggressively. And I would argue that's not the case with treasuries alone. If you're a skilled trader, you can have a period where you're seemingly wrong, losing money back, you know, week after week, day after day, month after month, whatever it will be. And then very suddenly there's a fat pitch. Mm-hmm. And you can really make it all back suddenly, right? This idea of magnitude versus frequency. So from your own trading style, it sounds like you're much more on the frequency side of trading. But how do you assess whether there might be sort of a real magnitude trade? It's not just a question of confidence, right? It's a question of probabilities favoring some kind of outlier move.
Well, I think that goes back to the whole COVID thing. I think, you know, I knew it was coming. I just was trying not to go broke before it did, you know? I guess the thing is, I mean, I think people who look at correlations often get wrapped up a little too tightly in them. And then that's yet another indicator, right? So I actually don't look at correlations too much. I tend to look at them for short periods of time and then not worry about them. I mean, the fact that oil went to -50 while stocks were fine, means, I think, that they're not correlated on an absolute basis. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. But they don't, when I look at the charts, they don't look correlated to me. But I understand that, or just in a overall sense, but I understand on a day-to-day basis, they may move together, which is different, right? So the price movement going in the same general patterns and directionality, to me, is not a correlation so much as if one is going up and the other is going down, I don't care that they're moving together during the day. Do you know what I mean? So I in general, do not look at correlations because I think I would mess me up and I think I would get too wrapped up in them. And they don't always go together.
Right. And that's a valid point. I mean, correlations often change, right? It's like, as much as I've been ranting on Bitcoin as not being a risk-off asset because it does correlate to the NASDAQ, it's only correlating until it doesn't. But the key thing is always causation, right? It's like, is the causation there for a relationship to persist? In the case of treasuries to stocks, the causation is always around default risk, right? When you have higher volatility, default risk perceptions increase. That's why high yield sells off, spreads widen. That's why there's a flight to safety, because the safety is around the idea that the U.S. government won't default. Whether it's right or wrong, that's the perception. That's the sort of Pavlovian response, I think, when you have high volatility. Now, this year is clearly an exception, right? Because as I keep noting, long duration treasuries basically look like stocks in the decline, in the way that the move has played out. But at some point, presumably, you'll get back to some of that historical relationship. It's just, you know, maybe we're getting there, maybe not. But that's been sort of my own help, you know, for whatever it's worth. I want to go back a little bit. So you start off by saying, you know, you're a retail trader. You don't speak like one, to your credit, in the sense that, you know, you're obviously very knowledgeable and know a lot of things. I've spent a lot of time and self-education in the field. Do you think that, let's call it old Wall Street, do you think that they get it wrong as far as how they think about retail? Because you often hear that term, that retail is quote unquote the dumb money. I've always had an issue with that term because it's not about intelligence, right? To me, it's maybe misinformed or not fully educated money as opposed to dumb money. But I'm just curious your thoughts on if you think that people get the view of retail traders wrong in terms of how they approach markets.
Well, I think there's a difference between the term trader and gambler. And I think that at some point, everyone for themselves needs to differentiate in their own minds what the difference between those two terms is. And it's okay if you're both, but I think the key to not just, you know, it's sort of like if you go to Vegas and you win big on the first night, you still want to play, but you feel like if I keep playing, I'm probably going to give back every single thing I did. It's the same thing with trading, right? So somebody could have an initial trade, you know, a lot of people got rich off of, I don't know if they did, because I don't know if they sold, but off of, you know, the GME, the AMC phenomenons, those sorts of things. So I think it's more about being consistent and finding a consistent method that works for you or that doesn't, that you can eliminate, more than actually being one or the other. That's my two cents on it.
And I think arguably there was a lot of that last year. Once you call gamblers, I would call the uneducated speculators, I kept on railing on all last year. The degree of uneducated speculation I kept on saying was astounding back then. Do you think a lot of that has come out of the marketplace? You know, you're much closer to a lot of this than I am, maybe in terms of different forums that you're looking at and researching or posting on, aside from Twitter, I assume. But do you think a lot of that has come out, or do you think there's still a lot of this kind of gambler's mentality in markets today?
I think a lot of it has come out. And I know that because I'm getting more intelligent questions than I was during that period. So, or maybe I have self-selected the most amazing people on Twitter to interact with. And maybe that's the case, because I've definitely been impressed with some of the people that I've interacted with on Twitter. I mean, I follow some smart people, and some really smart people have interacted with me on different trades. And I do respect everybody who has a different opinion. But I do think that some of the excess is out. I think, you know, people have decided that they need to get jobs. So that's good. And actually, you know, I think it's easier if you want to learn how to be a trader. It is easier to do with less emotion if you have a consistent source of income. It makes everybody, I think, a better trader.
No, that's such a great, because to the earlier discussion point, right? When you have to pay monthly bills that don't have the same degree of volatility as your monthly trading gains, right? That makes you maybe take on excess risk because you get desperate. Right. If you're in a drawdown and now you've got to pull money out to pay some credit card bill or to pay some rent, whatever it would be.
Right. No, I do pay myself every month too. So for me, their money is constantly leaving my account. It's very rare that I put money in. And if I do, it's for some specific purpose. Like I found a new thing that I want to go hard on or something like that. And for me, it's about how much money you can take out and keep the balance increasing.
Let's talk about the process of self-education for a moment. I went to college. I got a degree in finance and management, got the CFA charter. I've always joked around that even though I don't really speak like a CFA charter holder, you know, you have to kind of know what other CFA charter holders know to find their weaknesses to some extent, right? In terms of the way they analyze markets to come up with your own strategy, right? So I had a very kind of formal education in the field and spent a lot of time also reading a ton of books on markets. How did you go about educating yourself? Were there certain authors, certain books, certain schools of thought, aside from Technologists, that you spent the time on that really kind of resonated with you, that this is the angle that I want to go at?
So I did not read any books. I did memorize some candle patterns and whether or not they were bullish or bearish. I study different people, you know, because sometimes I would think, because these people were popular, I would think that they must be really good. So I would study what they did. I would recreate their charts. I would reverse engineer them. And then I would realize that, like, you know, what you were saying before, that they might get a lot of likes for that, but that's not good. What are they doing? You know, so for me, it was about reverse engineering other people, figuring out, you know, who amongst those people were consistent, not necessarily always winning, but consistent, not saying, I'm the only one on FinTwit that I saw go long just now. You know, it's just disgusting when I read stuff like that, that, you know, it's very narcissistic. And even if they're good, it makes me cringe. But for me, it's more about just trying to reverse engineer what other people are doing, figuring out what's working for them and how they make that work, getting lucky enough to find people who don't mind answering questions, and then just, you know, trying to not lose money first and then trying to make money consistently.
And it's hard to find those people, right? Because
yes,
people gravitate towards the
scammers.
Or the soothsayer on the hill. And it's like, listen, I've got a large following and I put a lot of content and I'm always on the road and telling people to follow me. I once had somebody say to me, you know, you're very good at markets, but you're even better at being a self-promoter. And I kind of don't mind that, because it's like, if I don't promote myself, if I don't talk about my approach and pump that mentality up, that approach out, and talk about these papers and research, well, nobody else is going to do it for me. And especially right. When you're an entrepreneur, who else? For you, except the person in the arena, right?
Or there's a lot of very competitive people that may want to just take you down. I have people that I know follow me, but don't follow me. I know they follow me with alt accounts because they respond to me almost immediately on certain things, but they don't actually follow me. So it's like, that's weird. But generally speaking, there's a lot of people that are just waiting for other people to fail or to seem like as if they do, so they can poach followers. And it's just the most asinine thing I can imagine. But you, I mean, actually talking to you now, I am pleasantly impressed with what I'm hearing, because you sound more legitimate than I thought you would, just because you have so many followers. I was like, oh no, I don't know. Like I didn't know if I wanted to talk today, because I didn't know if that's all you were is really good at self-promotion, but I'm really impressed.
No, I appreciate that. And again, like I said, all the few and exquisites, it's like, this is an online brand that I'm putting out there. And I think it's kind of funny. And it's also me just pointing fun at the idea that people think they know something when everybody probably knows it. It's like pointing out the obvious and saying, if you understand, this is obviously me being sarcastic. And I'm very open in this. Look, I'm going through a lot of, you know, professional and personal pain. I have no problem saying that. And I'm going through a nasty drawdown in a nasty environment. In my world, I need risk on, risk off dynamics to hold, meaning treasuries acting inverse to equities. And I need to be able to wait it out for when that relationship comes back. And I can't just stay quiet in the periods where the environment's not favoring my approach. Everything, you know, to your point about reverse engineering, everything I have out there can be reverse engineered. Anybody can look at the indices. Anybody can understand the data. The problem, to your point, is that when you have a large following, you'll have people that want to kick you when you're down. And it's silly because everybody goes through drawdowns. Everyone goes through pain. This idea that you have to beat somebody else's performance is silly.
I 1,000% agree with you. In a million years, would I never go to somebody who I knew took a losing trade and say, hey, how'd that work out for you? I don't have any interest in knowing. I know how my own trades that didn't work out for me worked out for me. I would just as soon focus on myself and focus on being better than I was the week before, the month before, the year before, and being able to be valuable to other people. I couldn't care less about kicking somebody else when they're down. But it is human nature. It is. It just, you know, all the people who pick on Jim Cramer, and I'm not on FinTwit to be a part of that. I don't want anything to do with it. I couldn't care less. I don't find it funny when people are critical of other people. I don't find it constructive. I don't think it's going to make me a better trader. I just focus on what I'm doing. And then there's a core group of people, and it's getting larger because I'm having smarter and smarter people follow me whose opinions I respect and I want to get occasionally just to make sure I'm not insane or to confirm that I am. So I'm more about being, it's not popular. It's not a popular thing not to make fun of people or be bad, but I just don't care. I would rather be less popular and more productive.
No, well said. I think that's a good way to end the space. First time you and I talked, Julie, I appreciate the hour. I know it was last minute when I told you, you know, if you're open to doing this today, you know, I had a slot open. But this was a very good conversation because I do think in general that it you don't get to know somebody based on a tweet. You don't even get to know somebody based on a space, but you can get closer to it. Right? I think that's sort of the way to frame it. So thank you everyone for joining. Thanks, Julie. We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye, everybody. See you later.
Thank you, everybody. Cheers.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.